Hello, my dear, sweet, darling, glorious bubbles of sentient meat. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. This episode is a good one, friends. This is a true blazer, and I'm really excited to put it up. We've got Sharon Salzberg here with us today, and Sharon Salzberg is one of the renowned is a weird word to put in front of Buddhist teachings, because Buddhism is so much about non-ego related vocabulary, I guess, or not attaching medallions to people. But as an unenlightened person in this world, I would give Sharon Salzberg multiple trophies, because she is such an incredible teacher and so down to earth, and has such a very simple yet incredibly powerful surgical approach to getting people unstuck and dealing with just the day-to-day issues that all of us inevitably come into contact with. And that's what most of the really great teachers are good at. They're not people who can levitate fruit or teleport or walk through walls, or they're not people who have some kind of extrasensory abilities. They're not people who have the stigmata. They're not people who can do magical acts. Usually my experience has been that these people are the most down to earth and have dealt with the very things that all of us are dealing with, but have been taught how to approach them from different angles that many of us haven't thought of, and their ability to articulate that approach in a very simple yet very usable way is what makes them teachers. And Sharon Salzberg, she's at the top of the charts. She blew my mind in this podcast, and it's really, I can't wait for you guys to hear it. I get really blown away by Buddhism and by Buddhist teachers, because when they're teaching you, what you're experiencing is not just something happening in language, but you're experiencing this strange ball of healing energy that is emerging from the past and has been transmitted from teacher to student to teacher to student to teacher. They call it the disciplic transmission is one word for it. And whenever you get to come into contact with these beings, whether it's through a conversation, if you're lucky enough to have one with them, or through their writings, or through people who have met them, then you always get this, I can't explain it, but you always get this little magical burst of transcendent energy that they inject into you, and they use language as kind of the box that they store the energy in, as the capsule or the membrane that surrounds the energy, but the words always become irrelevant compared to the effect that the energy has on you. And in Buddhism, this is the Dharma, the Dharmic transmission, I guess is what they call it. I'm sure they have a lot of, I'm not going to pretend, I always pretend like I know the names for this stuff, but I'm sure there's a name that they have for it. It's the very same thing that happens when you come across someone who really loves you, and you get that feeling of being loved for a second. It wakes you up to the realization that the universe isn't such a rough and tumble, dreadful, wretched, muddy old place where everyone's just trying to get an extra punch in before the Grim Reaper drags them down into hell. You realize that, in fact, in the universe, there are parts of the universe, human beings, these compassionate spokes in a whole different set of gears that runs a whole different kind of universe than the one that you might be accustomed to if you're somebody who tends to get lost in self-hate or hatred of others, or if you're someone who tends to feel despair or like you just can't do this shit anymore. And even if you could do this shit anymore, it's a kind of pointless endeavor anyway, because the whole goddamn thing is just a giant mound of festering pointlessness, and human beings are the flies flying around it and dining on the hopelessness as though there were a delicious steak dinner when in fact it's just a kind of existential shit that we're all buzzing around on. That's one universe you can get stuck in. And these teachers out there like Sharon Salzberg, they're people who can sort of pull your head out of the toilet bowl, so to speak, and allow you at least momentarily to experience a universe that isn't one where you are soaking in shit water. And that's a very powerful and incredible thing that these people do. And I think that it's a beautiful and wonderful part of the universe, as beautiful and wonderful as sunsets, sunrises, as beautiful and wonderful as the smell of flowers, as beautiful and wonderful as rivers running through mountains. It's the very same kind of, you know what I was looking for there? Natural beauty. That's what these people put out. They're human beings who have become possessed with a kind of natural beauty that comes through their teachings. And whenever you get to catch a little taste of it, whenever you get to catch that smell of it, whenever you get to, you get the same feeling that you get when you are out in the woods and everything's quiet except for the wind blowing through the trees and the sound of the birds singing and this sort of soaring expansiveness and hopefulness fills up your heart, and it feels like this terrible heaviness that you've been carrying around with you is lifted off momentarily. And in that moment of experiencing that kind of spiritual zero gravity state that these people allow you to, or teach you to feel, or open up for you, you regain the hope that you might have lost if you've been slogging through the muddy fields of delusion, which are so easy to find yourself stuck in. Maybe hope's the wrong word for it. Maybe what they do is they show you who you really are, which is you are the same thing that is a river flowing through mountains. You're the same thing that is wind blowing through a forest. You're composed of the identical quantum material that makes up all of nature, and nature is beautiful. Nature doesn't make mistakes. Nobody looks at a sunset and thinks, God, that sunset really isn't working hard enough today. You just think, wow, that's a beautiful sunset. Look at the moon. No one looks at the moon and thinks, God, Jesus, it just really seems to have fallen off lately in the way that it's shining up there through the clouds. It used to be so much more connected with its moon-like qualities. You just think it's a beautiful moon, and you're made of the same stuff. And they're healers. I don't think there's much of a difference between a teacher and a healer. And the healing is that they do is by helping you just for a second come out of the amnesia that has caused you to forget that you are the sunset and the sunrise and the moon and the mountains and the rivers and the flowers and the muskrats. Even muskrats are, maybe you're not a muskrat. They're not so cute. I guess they're kind of cute. Whatever it is out there, you're the same thing. You're just as welcome to this party as the most beautiful mountain and as the deepest, most refreshing river and as any other component of nature. You're just as welcome to the party. And instead of moping around in the corner feeling like you don't fit in here, these teachers invite you to start dancing again. And I'm really grateful that they exist, and I'm excited for you to hear this interview. We're going to dive right into it. But first, some quick business. Today's episode of the Dunkin' Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by Harry's.com. Harry's.com is a company that sells precision-engineered razor blades and fancy razor blade handles and super nice shaving cream for about half the price of what you're going to pay if you go to one of those doom drug stores and wait behind a 16-inch plexiglass cage where the overpriced awful razors are sold for a manager to come and with shaking hands unlock it as though he's opening up the Fort Knox to bring out gold bars. Don't go through that crap. Go to Harry's.com and do yourself a favor and order some nice blades. I don't advertise anything on this podcast that I don't use. And until I started working with Harry's, if I heard the term precision engineered blade, then my ass would tighten up and my ears would shut down as though somebody had poured wax inside of them, because it honestly doesn't sound real, but it does make a big difference. Harry's will give you a fancy shave. It's the kind of shave that Prince gets in between recording albums when he has one of his genetically modified sexless shaving drones come and shave his face with blades that were forged in some palace in the Middle East. You can have that same experience without paying the $50 million that Prince pays for his razors and having to genetically engineer a sexless shaving drone. Just by going to Harry's.com, you can have shipped to your house a really nice box with a really fancy razor in it. And for a few minutes a day, you could pretend that you are some prince whose body has been coated in a rare kind of cream by your sex slaves, and who for a moment is experiencing the glory of fancy shaving. And for a limited time only, because the holidays are approaching, Harry's is offering folks $5 off their Winter Winston set. So if you want to treat yourself for the holidays, or if you want to send somebody a really fancy razor blade, you can get $5 off by going to harrys.com and putting in promo code FAMILYHOURHOLIDAY. That's FAMILYHOURHOLIDAY, and you will get a $5 off the Winter Winston set. The Winter Winston set is super cool. It's like a shimmering blue handle, fancy blades. And here's the kicker. For an extra $15, you can have three letters engraved on the handle. And so you can have engraved on there, you know, if you have a paranoid friend, you could have engraved CIA. Or if you have a friend who loves psychedelics, you could have LSD engraved in the blade so that whenever they're shaving, they could be reminded of their favorite chemical. You could have engraved in the blade, if you want it to be an erotic blade, you could have engraved into the blade ASS, ass. So anytime they're shaving, they can just think about an ass. Any of these possibilities are there for you. Go to harrys.com. Enter in promo code FAMILYHOURHOLIDAY, and even if you already are someone who gets Harry's razor blade shipped to you, you're still going to get $5 off this cool razor blade. And by the way, it's a cool gift. If you want to like send something to somebody you can't figure out what to get for them, if you're just not feeling like dealing with thinking very hard about gifts to give people, if you know somebody whose face looks like demons have been clawing at it because they use crappy razor blades, you could even write that to them. You could say, I've sent you this gift because your face looks like demons are attacking you on a daily basis because you use shitty razor blades. Why don't you experience what it's like to get the shave of a noble lord? Experience what it's like to have the face of, I'm sure if Jesus shaved, he would use Harry's, and that's why it's the perfect gift for the holidays. Go to harrys.com, put in Family Hour Holiday, you get $5 off the Winter Winston set. And do support these sweeties because they support this podcast. This podcast is also brought to you by Amazon.com. By now, you're probably aware of the fact that shopping during the holiday season is very similar to participating in the running of the bulls. If you want to get trampled by angry people who are trying to get $6 off an overpriced TV, then go out into the world and shop. If you want to waste your time in traffic, going into those existential anxiety moments as you analyze your life and realize that you're one of the millions of genetic meat pockets who are going out to buy shit for a holiday that's been hijacked by corporations, then go out there in the world, inhale Ebola sneezes, get infected with some kind of strange gonorrhea because you end up in a weird romantic relationship with somebody stocking shelves at your local mall, go do that and see what happens. Your life will spiral down. You'll probably end up being attacked by a jaguar or a cougar that someone was showing at a local mall for the kids who broke free of its chains. What I'm saying is, if you go to a mall, there's an 80% chance a tiger will eat you in front of your family. Don't do it. Go to Amazon.com, but first go through our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. You can do all your holiday shopping through Amazon.com. And I am not joking when I say that if you want to give a great gift to someone, a life-changing gift to somebody, give them a bidet. Order a bidet for them and send it to them from Amazon for the holidays. They'll make fun of you until they install the thing and experience what it's like to have a gloriously clean asshole. Send them a bidet. I highly recommend that, but give them any gift. If you go through the portal located at DuncanTrussell.com, they give us a small percentage of anything that you buy. So it's a great way for you to support this podcast without having to spend any money at all. And for those of you, we have had record t-shirt sales. For those of you who have been buying t-shirts, God bless you. Thank you so much for buying our shirts. We've got brand new shirts located at the shop at DuncanTrussell.com. We have Ron Rigi Enneagram shirts. These shirts have been inscribed with a sigil that contains various symbols from Western and Eastern spiritual traditions that are all designed not only to ward off evil, negative energy, but to draw into your life beauty, positivity, love, hope. And you're going to have, if you're somebody who gets embarrassed by sitting at the park and having woodland animals sit on your lap or birds sing to you or land on your shoulder and sing to you, then don't get these shirts, because there is a very small chance that that could happen to you. We've been getting some complaints from people who are a little embarrassed because when they're on a first date, a baby deer will wander up to them and lick their hand, or a baby rabbit will jump into their laps in front of their date. And so some people get really embarrassed by that. But if you're somebody who isn't embarrassed by that, maybe get one of these shirts. There is a percentage chance that could happen if your heart is pure and if you're a virgin. Go to DuncanTrussell.com. Go to the shop. We've also got posters, Family Hour logo t-shirts, and we're going to have mugs in there soon. So check in the shop, buy some cool gifts for your loved ones for the holidays, or just buy stuff for yourself and don't buy gifts for anybody. It's really a big scam ultimately, but it's a game that we all participate in, I guess. Go to DuncanTrussell.com, order shirts there. Also, my sweet darling friends, I am going on tour. If you go to DuncanTrussell.com, you can see that I will be doing live podcasts, and these are going to be in Austin and Houston. There was supposed to be one in Dallas. They haven't. I don't know if that's happening for sure, but Austin and Houston on the 23rd of January and the 24th of January, I'm going to be at the Come and Take It Comedy Takeover Festival. That's in Houston, 24th and 25th. And I'm going to be at the Parish in Austin at the 23rd, recording live podcasts. Get tickets now, because these shows tend to sell out. Don't put off getting these tickets. Get them now. Why not? Dive into it. Just buy the tickets. Okay, that's it. Those are the advertisements. You don't have to do any of this stuff. I'm just happy that you guys listen at all. And if you get annoyed with these advertisements, do remember that you can jump right into the interviews. You don't have to waste time listening to commercials. That's one of the beauties of the internet, which is allowing us to escape from the tyrannical corporate hypnotism that we all must inflict upon ourselves if we want to watch an episode of any TV show without downloading it or buying it from iTunes. So, blah, blah, blah. I love you guys. I'm excited for you to hear this podcast. Today's guest is a renowned Buddhist teacher. She's the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. She's been a student of meditation since 1971. She's written numerous books, the most recent being Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. If you're somebody who is entangled in a job and you're experiencing the conflict and anxiety that goes along with being in any job, this is a great book to read. She is a contributor to the Huffington Post. She's written other books such as Real Happiness, The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program, Love Your Enemies, Faith, Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience, and Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. You can find out more about her by going to SharonSalzberg.com. I'm going to have all the links at DuncanTrussell.com, including the link to her latest book, Real Happiness at Work. So now, everybody, please open up your heart chakras and send as much love as you possibly can to wherever Sharon Salzberg happens to be existing in the time-space continuum. Welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, Sharon Salzberg. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to be on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a real honor that you're here. You're one of the most renowned Buddhist teachers in the West, I would say. And it's very exciting for me to get to talk with you. Just to get right into it, I want to talk with you about dealing with anger, because it seems like you have a real deep understanding of what anger is and how to handle it when it pops into your life.
Okay. Well, in Tibetan Buddhism, they say that anger is that which we pick up when we feel weak, because we want to feel strong. We think it's going to make us strong. And within Buddhist teaching in general, there is a strength to anger that's admitted and spoken about. It's an energy. And as an energy, it plays a very positive role sometimes. It helps us make boundaries and have a sense of integrity, like this is a violation, this is beyond what I can tolerate. Sometimes the angriest people in the room are the most honest. It's like everyone else is looking the other way or trying to pretend something isn't wrong. And that angry person is saying, look there, you know?
Yeah.
So there could be an honesty to it. And certainly an energy. We're not passive. We're not complacent. But it also can be so phenomenally self-destructive, as well as, of course, destructive to relationships and so on. They say that anger is like a forest fire which burns up its own support, so it can leave us devastated. And like a forest fire, it can range really wild and can leave us very far from where we actually want to be, because there's also a sort of delusion in anger sometimes. It's like if you think about the last time you were really angry at yourself, however long ago that might have been, and it's not usually a time where you're also thinking, you know, I made that terrible mistake, and I did 5 great things that very same morning. Usually those 5 great things, they are gone. They have disappeared. All we can remember, what we actually obsess about, is that terrible mistake.
Well, they don't and that is true. And you know, one thing that you mentioned in a talk that you gave is that thinking about those 5 things is like nails on a chalkboard. It's a, there's no emotional resonance, especially compared to the overwhelming energy and frequency that comes from anger, because it's such a powerful thing. But the thing that I'm confused about is anger comes. I can't really do anything about the initial emotional burst that happens. From my rather lazy approach to meditation and mindfulness, I can do a thing where the anger comes and I don't react to it immediately. And I think, oh, look, you're getting angry. So now we're not going to react. But it's that place mm-hmm. I want to talk with you about, because in that mm-hmm. kind of liminal spot between the feeling and when you decide how you're going to act, this is the place that seems to give birth in my life to not a compassionate place, but more of a kind of phony place where it's like, I'm angry, but I'm going to act like I'm not. And so I'm curious, how do you authentically react to an emotion that, and I know mm-hmm. you mentioned all these wonderful things that can come from anger. My experience with it has been 95% of the time it's destructive. So
it is very destructive. And I think that's an important point. The reason I started with the kind of positive parts of it is because it's not that useful to condemn ourselves and to think, you know, this is all completely screwed up. There is an energy there. And what we want to do is to be able to utilize that energy without being lost in either the fixation of the anger, like I'm just that mistake, or you are just that person who did that thing, or get lost in obsession. You know how we like to go over the list of somebody's faults, and yes. we just go over it and over it and over it and over it. We don't even think of a new fault. It's just like same list.
Yes.
But we go over it and over it and over it and over it. So a lot of our life's energy is kind of wasted in grudges and resentment. And, you know, it's a very debilitating state. So it's really important to understand we want to capture that energy without condemning ourselves for what we're feeling and without getting lost in the anger. So that's the very delicate dance of mindfulness. And I want to say what you described yourself as doing, I think, is very good and powerful. It's not like it's not like second best, because we cannot control what arises in our minds. We cannot. And it doesn't mean that when you get really good at meditation that anger will never arise. It becomes more porous, you know, less solid seeming, more like a cloud moving through the sky. But it still may arise. And the kind of despair that we feel and the self-blame that we feel is really extra, because you're not going to be able to control it, but it's not going to matter in the same way. So the first thing is to know what we're feeling as we're feeling it, not like 15 consequential actions later. You know, not after you've gone off to the computer and typed out the email and pressed send, and not after you've, you know, one of my favorite definitions of mindfulness is came from an article in the New York Times many years ago about a pilot program bringing mindfulness to a fourth grade classroom in Oakland, California. And there were two quotations in it that I especially liked. One was, they talked to one of the researchers and he said, all day long we tell kids to pay attention, but we never teach them how. And then they asked one of the kids, so the kid's like in fourth grade, he's like 9 or 10 years old. They said to him, what is mindfulness? What is mindfulness? And he said, mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. That's what mindfulness means. And I thought, great definition. You know, because what does that imply? It means knowing you're starting to feel angry when you're starting to feel angry, right? You're that in touch, you're that in tune with what's going on within. And it also implies actually a kind of balanced relationship to that anger, because if you just fall into it, you get swallowed up. You have no center. You have no space from what the varying emotions that come and go are doing. Then you're going to probably hit a lot of people in the mouth. And on the other hand, if you hate the anger and you fear it and you can't stand that it's there, and you just get tighter and tighter and tighter, and then you explode and anything can happen. So we talk about mindfulness as that place in the middle where you know what's happening, you can recognize it. You're not sucked into it. You're also not pushing against it. That's like the sweet spot right there.
Yes.
It's quite magic. So every time we feel that anger and we do not act on it, it's a conscious choice. It's not second best. It's saying, maybe, you know, that kid had a moment. It's like he created some space with his mindfulness in which he could reflect, you know, I hit someone in the mouth last week. Didn't work out that well.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Let me try this. We try that.
But I don't, you know, it's like, what you're talking about and what many Buddhist teachers are talking about reminds me of the difference between fossil fuel and solar power. And many of us have learned to be fueled by anger and by despair and by that either hating the self or loathing the self for not being able to control this stuff, or loathing the people around us for the very same crime. And so it's kind of like you're saying, just install solar panels into your factory that used to burn the blackest of coal. But it's the problem is once I get the solar panels in, I don't know how to run the gears. I don't know how to work the machine. I don't know how to, in that space, I don't know what to do after that. Because if I'm so addicted to either, you know, pointing out what someone has done that's wrong, or thinking, oh, Duncan, you're just a neurotic asshole, that I don't know the length, I don't understand how to do the dance that you're taught. I can kind of hear the music. I don't know the dance moves. And to put it into concrete terms, if I'm with somebody and they're doing something that's clearly obnoxious or threatening or whatever, and I don't let anger dictate the way that I respond to them, then I feel completely lost at sea.
Well, that's why we have a practice, right?
Yeah.
That's why we have a path, really, truly, because, I mean, of course, everything you're saying, I think, is totally accurate. And it's why, in a way, it also takes a lot of courage to want to be different. And sometimes that courage comes because we've really suffered, you know. It's like anger is a very consequential emotion, not the feeling of it, but the acting on it. You know, people destroy a lot through their anger, you know, the expression of their anger. And because it's very, there's a quality in anger when we're lost in it, not just feeling it, but lost in it. That's also kind of diluted. You know, we forget so much in that moment. It's like, I sometimes tell this story about years and years ago, when I was first doing email, like the very first time. And I was trying to do something, and something went wrong in the relationship between my computer and my printer. And just before then, I was online, and I actually got an email from somebody who said, which was always very exciting, and said something like, can you tell me something about what's the problem with anger, with being lost in anger? And I wrote to him and I said, you know, one of the problems with being lost in anger is that when we're lost in it, we just put people in a box. And then I got offline. I was trying to do this project, and that's when something went terribly wrong in the relationship between my computer and my printer, and I got really angry. And the first person I was angry at was we didn't even have the phrase IT then, like my computer assistant. And I was really angry because I thought, wow, you know, he was in Hawaii on vacation, and I thought, he's never here when I need him. He's like totally betrayed me. He's gone off to Hawaii. And I forgot in that moment what was literally true, which was that the reason he was on vacation is because I had decided he needed a vacation. And the reason he was in Hawaii was because I had gone to the airport and used my frequent flyer miles to get him a ticket to Hawaii. It's like I forgot that.
Yes.
In just being lost in the moment. And I also was really angry at myself. Like, why can't you be the kind of person who can fix these things? Can never do these kind of things. You know, why can't you fix it? And it was like, in the meantime, I fixed it, you know, but I hardly even took a moment to appreciate it, you know, and because I was just so locked in. So then I got back up, I fixed it. I got back up into my chair and I wrote, you know, my thing. And then I went back online and I saw that there was an email from my original correspondent And he said, I don't understand what you mean when you say that when you're lost in anger, you just put people in a box. So then I wrote to him and I said, this is what I just did. I put that guy in a box. I put myself in a box. And so that's the learning. You know, this is what anger really feels like. It's not as strong. We don't get as strong as we think we're going to get. Mm. We don't have as many options when we're lost there. That's the learning. And we have to learn that again and again and again, because then what happens is that, you know, someone is being obnoxious and there's all this stuff happening. And you remind yourself, I'm not wrong to feel what I'm feeling, but I'm not going to act on it right now. I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to maybe write out the email and not press send right away.
But
I'm going to say to somebody, I'll get back to you, something like that.
But what if you're sitting in front of them or living with them, or what if they're there is no. So
it happens.
I'm good at that I'll get back to you thing. I can really pull that off. And if there was a way when I started feeling angry that I could vanish into some alternate universe and just look at flowers for a few hours and then appear back in the same second, I'd be great. But man, you're right across from the person. You're in that moment with the person in the small scale, was someone in your family mm-hmm. or someone you live with, but in the big scale, you know, you're somebody in Ferguson staring at police officers dressed like Darth Vader who are statistically very likely to kill you, or at least more likely to kill you than most uh-huh. other things in your environment. What about those moments? Because uh-huh. there's nothing's changing with them, no matter how peaceful you get.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I don't want to be glib about these things. It's just that we suffer so much from not realizing we might have alternatives. So with your family member, you know, a lot would depend on what's the contract, what's the understanding. Even, you know, do you want to stretch the boundaries? There are ways. I mean, it also depends how vulnerable do you want to be? How much do you want to reveal? Because sometimes underneath the anger is sadness, it's disappointment, it's frustration, it's grief, it's guilt, whatever, and fear. And you might perhaps be in a relationship with that person where it's certainly a more authentic form of communication to say, I feel really disappointed. I was hoping for that card, you know. Or, you know, because I wrote this book, Real Happiness at Work. It comes up a lot in terms of work, you know, and even though it's a little bit formulaic or feels weird, you know, to actually, it's actually more useful to say, you know, I really needed that memo to come in by Friday. And because it didn't, you know, I'm not able to go on vacation. And these 15 people are going to have to work harder, you know, so I'm really disappointed. I think this can't go on. It tends to be more useful than you're an idiot, you know,
yes,
and you never get anything done, you know, but you may not in every relationship want to be that vulnerable and reveal more of what's going on. So that's a decision, you know, like in terms of family. And sometimes there are a lot of surprises that happen in a really good way when, you know, when we can be more authentic in those ways. And at least we feel, you know, we don't feel that kind of regret afterwards. Like I just tried to destroy them. I tried to damage them in some way. You know, I said what I had to say. I was clear. And then in terms of Ferguson or some awful situation, you know, we don't have many models, but we have some of people who with enormous courage really got out there. And it's the mistake that people perpetually make, that nonviolence means passivity and that you're just gonna you know, take it. And it's really not. I think if you ask many an activist kind of living in perpetual outrage is too much, you know, it's too exhausting. It's too debilitating. It's like maybe we need the fuel of that outrage to be active. That's the energy, right? The energy of the anger. But you can't just constantly abide in that environment because you burn out. And so how is a sustained action really, really performed? You know, how do we hang in there? It's like, how can you be steady? How can you be compassionate in a situation where it's not obvious you're going to be able to fix it?
Yes.
You know, that you can make it all better.
Exactly. That is so, that, what you just said, that's the root of the thing for me. Where, and I guess it illuminates the fact that my whole practice is based on manipulation of my external environment. Which is pretty, but because if it's not going to get the thing I want, then it's like, well, then why am I doing it really? What's the point?
And well, isn't that incredible? Like to have a really big picture of time and not to be lost in the kind of ordinary frustrations that come because of our impatience. Like, it's got to work out now.
Yes. Now. Like, if I'm going to do this pause between reacting to whatever the thing is that you did, then within the next 10 minutes, I want you to transform into a completely different person.
There you go.
So it's actually, it seems like what I'm really doing is just another form of aggression. It's not even the thing. It's just, I'm tricking myself into thinking that this pause that I'm doing is of any merit at all, when it really is just waiting for someone else to be different.
Well, let me try to cheer you up. I think you're doing better than you think you're doing.
Thank you.
I mean, I wouldn't dismiss it, you know, out of hand in that way, because we, you know, it's step by step. And even coming to the pause is a very big thing. You know, to understand the difference between what we feel and how we respond, how we act. That is a very big thing. And then we just get wiser. And we have, and it's one of the reasons we actually need one another. We need usually a sense of community. Because these things are not always that easy to figure out all alone. And like that moment and that pause, you know, for somebody to say, you know, like you just said, I thought I was really being cool. And I, you know, I thought it was the kind of pause that opened up all the space, but really there was a lot of expectation in there. Allows someone else to notice that about themselves. And it's good.
Right. Yeah. I understand I love the aspect of Buddhism that invites you to not be in a hurry. And I've heard various ways of describing how long we're here in this thing, and that trying to suddenly become this ideal is just creating more of the same kind of reactions. But sometimes it just seems so imperative to make decisive moves, decisive actions. I know what you're talking about, what you're saying. I recognize how powerful it is, because when I really contemplate that idea of not reacting to anger and being in the moment and not for any other reason than not to change the people around me, it makes me feel like when I was a kid sitting at the edge of a high dive or something, you know, like this, it's terrifying. And I know, and I want to keep saying not just for me, just because I don't want to sound like a coward, I guess. But I'm a comedian. I'm friends with comedians, and again and again and again, I've heard from comedians, if I stop being angry, I'm done. I won't be funny anymore. I'm not going to have anything to talk about on stage. I'm not going to be able to express myself artistically. And something about this, it creates the same kind of feeling in me, which is, it makes me feel powerless. I don't understand how power, how to be powerful while feeling love. I don't know how to, or compassion. It's hard for me to imagine that. When I feel love or compassion, I feel so desperately vulnerable and so terrified and so prone to instantly shutting down and being like, well, I opened myself up to you and you are an asshole. So this is what you get. I'll never do it again.
Well, isn't there, I mean, there are different kinds of humor, right? And they're not necessarily all fueled by anger. They may all be, or many of them are fueled by stepping away, right? By having another kind of vision and not being caught, you know, by the ordinary day-to-day kind of obsessive consumerism of life.
Yes. You know?
And just the values of, you know, that might run our world. We have to step away. I mean, that's what art is, right? It's moving away. It's being on the edge in some sense. And
yes.
And looking back or looking differently, but with a much bigger vision. But, I mean, there's a kind of humor in just the human predicament, right? And,
yes.
And you know, maybe it's ironic humor more than kind of brutal humor, but the irony of being a human being and this life is pretty funny.
Yes.
In its own way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think maybe what you're saying is also like it's a reflection of something people have asked for a long time, which is like, well, if I, a lot of people believe great art comes from anguish and it has to come from this tremendous internal suffering and turmoil and
yes,
not always so nice for the artist, but.
Right. That's right.
You know, and that is a very Western way of thinking. In the East, of course, you know, you'd have, you know, calligraphy or something, you know, that you'd have forms of art that really came from a sense of internal harmony and balance and compassion. And it wasn't at all felt that states of wisdom and compassion left you not creative. You know, that's where creativity came from.
But Sharon, there's no calligraphy channel. There's no one...
Compared to the Comedy Channel?
Yeah, compared to any other Walking Dead or, you know, any of the great shows or movies or, you know, these are like so much of them, you could just tell they're so fueled by that anguish that you're talking about. That's a very real thing. And I you know, I was just around a comedian who I consider to be one of the funniest comedians working right now. I won't say his name, but he, in this weird quick moment, he said, you know, if I just always have to be busy because I'm afraid if I sit still just for a second, I'm going to have to deal with all this shit inside of me. And I thought, yeah, you don't know that you just said, you know, you just described having a spiritual practice and, you know, that moment you look at him and realize how sad this guy is crucifying himself. And the result of this crucifixion is truly brilliant comedy that is, you know, making him, not just making him a ton of money, but making people laugh so hard. So it's, that's the fear, you know, is it, there's a real sacrifice in giving up the addiction to the anguish, the anger, the negative mood states is fuel for the way that you behave.
Well, I mean, it may be a sacrifice. It's certainly a transformation.
Yes.
You know, and you don't know what you lose and what you gain until you have that sense of adventure. First of all, in Buddhist psychology, anger and fear can be considered the same mind state. They're just two different forms. And, you know, the anger is the outflowing, expressive, energized form. The fear is the held in, frozen, imploding form of wanting to separate from what's happening, wanting to strike out against what's happening. And you know, we probably tend to romanticize anger. We don't tend to romanticize fear. So the way you just described your friend saying, I'm afraid of stopping. I'm afraid of looking inside. You know, I'm afraid of really knowing what I'm feeling. That's not that inviting, you know, as a
right.
you know, and then you think, well, what would happen if you were in touch, if you weren't so afraid, if you weren't so bound to the fear? You know, all kinds of things might happen as a result. And they don't make you bland, you know, and just kind of like, oh, I'm just going to be conventional and like everyone else. I don't see that being overcome by fear, guided by fear, is that great a thing?
No, I don't either. I don't even know what it, I mean, outside of the times I get to chat with people like you or Jack Kornfield or you know, people who actually are doing the work, you don't come into contact with it that often. It is fear. That is the root of it. I know it is in me, for sure. Mm-hmm. There's no question but that the reason that I get pissed off, if I'm mad at someone in my family, it's because I'm afraid, you know, generally it's because I'm afraid of the way they're going to act if I tell them how I really feel. Or if I'm, you know, in a relationship and I'm angry, it's always because I'm afraid of losing them and I don't want to be alone. Yeah. It's always fear. It really is pathetic. Yeah. Because you don't, you know, anger, you get angry and it's like, yeah, that's the angry guy. Don't mess with him. But you never want to be like, oh yeah, man, don't do anything that bothers him because he'll just start crying and run away in terror, or he's just a frightened man. No one wants to be a frightened man is the worst thing to be compared to an angry man. You know, archetypically, there's no frightened men who are heroes. The archetypical masculine form is an angry God. There's no Jehovah. If we take what you're saying into the new Old Testament, this angry God Jehovah. If we're saying that anger is the outflow of fear, then that means that Jehovah, the God in the Garden of Eden, obviously probably a myth, but that means he's a scared God.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Indeed. But, you know, I understand that way of thinking, you know, that the loss of that anger, that anguish is going to have us lose our creative edge. I just don't happen to think it's true, you know?
Oh, no. No, you're right. You're totally right. Yeah, I get it. It just popped into my head now. It's so nice to be chatting with you. I totally get it. Of course not. Of course it wouldn't do any. It's a way to avoid dealing with a fear. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line. Nobody wants to jump into that. I should have told you see if I knew what I was talking about in the beginning of this thing. I would have been like, let's talk about fear.
Yeah, well, that's good. Let's talk about compassion for oneself.
Okay.
Well, because that's the other side, in a way. You know, it's like when I teach meditation, which of course is what I do.
Yes.
I emphasize over and over and over and over and over again the moment after you've been distracted. Because let's just say you're using a method like settling your attention on the feeling of the breath, it's likely not going to be 9,000 breaths before your mind wanders. You know, it's going to be one or two.
Can you say that again, only because it fuzzed out a little bit? You said it's settling your attention.
Yeah, if your method, the method of practice that you're using,
yes,
is settling your attention on the feeling of the breath, something like that, or it could be a mantra, but let's say it's the breath. It's likely not going to be 9,000 breaths before your mind wanders. It's likely going to be like one or two or maybe four or five. And then your mind's going to jump to the past or jump to the future, judgment or speculation. And then comes a magic moment when you realize, oh, it's been quite some time since I last felt a breath.
Ah, yeah.
And that's actually considered the most important moment in the whole process. Because that's the moment we have the chance to be really different. So instead of judging ourselves or blaming ourselves or feeling like we failed, we practice letting go. And with some compassion for ourselves, we practice beginning again. And so you might have to let go and begin again 10 billion times in a meditation session, and that's not considered a problem. That's the actual training.
Wow.
But we're so down on ourselves as a general rule. You know, like, oh no, my mind wandered. I'm so bad. You know, yesterday I could only be with two breaths. Today I can only be with two breaths. I'm not making any progress. And usually people, that's one of the hardest things to believe, that it actually doesn't matter, that we're learning how to forgive ourselves and come back. We're learning how to start over. It's like a resilience practice in some way. And we take that, or it follows us. We're not even conscious sometimes of it, but it follows us right into life. You know, you make a mistake, you can bounce back, and you have a big aspiration, you lose sight of it, you can start over. You know, that's what we really need, because nothing in life is a straight shot, you know?
Yeah. Like,
we're always having to adjust and start over and remember and recover and repair and...
That's the worst. See, yeah, exactly. Because eventually you're just like, that's it. I'm just not going to do it again. I'm not starting over anymore, because every time I start over, the whole thing inevitably collapses. That's it. I'm just not going to write. I'm not going to try anything. I'm done exercise or whatever the thing is. Because every time I get moving just a little bit, personally, me, anytime I get going, sure as shit, I'm going to be looking back 2 months later thinking about, remember when you were meditating every day? Well, you failed again, Trussell. Eventually I get to the place where I'm like, well, I'm not even going to fool myself into thinking that I do this anymore, because every time I get going, I stop. And what you're saying is that is actually the practice too.
That's right. That is the path right there, because it's true for everybody. It's just not going to be a straight shot. And so being able to realize that that's normal. It's what one of my teachers once called exercising the letting go muscle.
Say that, exercising the...
You know, we let go, we start over. We say sometimes the healing is in the... We exercise letting go muscle.
And the healing is in the what?
The healing is in the return.
Oh, wild. That is wild. Wow. That is so sweet. That's the answer for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
That is the answer.
Wow. I just get so frustrated that I... Wow, that is really cool. Yeah, because I just, you know, I end up just wanting to give up, because I
know.
Huh.
I know. Well, people do end up wanting to give up, but that's why I think we need a different perspective, because it's not just comforting. It's true.
Yeah. Yes. No, of course. Yeah. No, it is. It is very true, but it just hearing it, just, it makes me feel this, like... It just, it's really, I can't even describe how good that feels. Huh. Yeah, because it's exhausting, though. I mean, the mindset that I have is exhausting, because you sort of just start looking at this, like, you know, ladder that you're supposed to be climbing, or the path, the process, whatever it is, and you always get up to a certain rung, and then sure enough, you just slip back down and you're screaming at somebody, or you're, you know, just exactly what you're saying. You're just lost. You're not even, not even anywhere. Just sort of just this swirl of static, this thing that's just this kind of state of like nausea, not to get too existential, but just this sense of like, ugh, you're just gone. And what you're saying is that moment where you're back just for a second. Yeah. Sorry, I don't mean to just be sort of stammering, but you definitely just blew my mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that is the moment. And we give very little appreciation to it. The moment we come back, we don't recognize that's a big deal to be able to come back. That's a huge transformation for most of us.
Right. Yeah, right. And that's compassion.
Yes, that's compassion. And it's essential because that's the way to get something done. That's the way to make a change. That's the way to really have an endeavor, you know, like make something happen, because it's always going to be up and down. It just is. And you know, we feel so much like we failed when we haven't. It's just a natural part of the process.
It's like there's a room in your house where you know you need to clean, and you keep shutting the door in that room because you don't even want to look in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the amount of work that you know that you've got to do. And anytime you start, if you don't know that thing that happens where you like start cleaning, I don't know if this happens to you. It happens to me. I smoke too much marijuana. So when I'm cleaning, inevitably you'll find like an old letter from somebody. And then you pick up the letter, you start reading the letter and feeling all this emotion for that person. And then that will lead you to going to find a picture of them or some other sentiment. The next thing you know, 4 hours has passed. You're playing video games because you didn't want to feel while you were cleaning, you know? Mm-hmm. And then by then it's like, you know, I'll just leave the place a mess. And this thing that you're talking about reminds me of that. And instead of just being, the idea is that once you realize, oh shit, I'm playing video games, I'll just get back to cleaning. You don't then think like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I just clean the damn house? What's my problem? I'm distracted. I have ADD or something. You actually realize like, oh no, this moment of realizing that I got lost again is that's the experience of the healing energy of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
How often do you get lost?
Well, I get lost a lot. I don't smoke any marijuana ever, but there are a lot of reasons we get lost. Yeah. I mean, really. But that's if I was going to say, or people ask all the time, because I've been meditating over 40 years now, and people say, you know, what's changed? What's different? And the truth is that that's what's different, is that there's so much more kindness toward myself and toward others, and I can just see, yes, you know, like we all make mistakes, we all can recover, we can come back, and that's the miracle.
Yeah, if somebody comes out of a coma just for a second, the people aren't going to be like, you are asleep, you lazy asshole. You sleep too much.
Exactly.
So why do that to yourself?
That's a very good point.
Just the fact that you even get these brief moments of waking up for a second, that's glorious, because is enlightenment the state of not falling asleep anymore, like that of not going, not losing your footing on reality? Or is that what an awakened person is?
That's my guess.
Have you ever come in contact with an enlightened being?
I feel like I have. I mean, they all would say no, you know, but I feel like I have, and that being certainly the more enlightened than I, you know, or they would say more enlightened than they used to be. So I trust that. And I think that's, you know, it's very genuine. And, you know, people are extraordinary. I've met extraordinarily loving and compassionate and wise people.
When did you realize that you were going to be a teacher?
Well, I realized I was going to be a teacher I'm not sure I even realized it. I had one of those extraordinarily loving, wise, enlightened, compassionate teachers who was a woman named Deepa Ma, which is a kind of nickname for Deepa's mother. Mm. And she was a person, she was like a model for me because...
I'm sorry, you faded out for one second. She was like
She was like a model for me.
Oh, okay.
Because she had a life of tremendous personal suffering, and she emerged from it with this amazing kind of compassion for everybody. Like she was a Bengali woman. She'd been placed in an arranged marriage when she was 12 years old, and she and her husband actually fell very deeply in love, which didn't always happen, but... then they didn't have children for about 18 years. And then they had three children and two of her children died. And then they were living in Burma, she and her family. At that point, her husband was in the civil service and he wasn't feeling well one afternoon and came home and had died by that night. So she was completely overcome by grief, and they said she developed a heart condition. She was so just overcome. And she went to bed. She couldn't get out. She didn't have the strength to get out of bed. The doctor came and he said to her, "You're actually going to die of a broken heart unless you do something about your mind." He said, "You should learn how to meditate." And so she still had Deepa, the one daughter, to raise. So she got out of bed and she went to the meditation center to learn how to meditate. And they said that she was so weak that she actually couldn't get up the stairs to go into the actual meditation room. So she crawled to get up into that room. And she learned how to meditate. She used her meditation practice both to experience a state of peace. And she just emerged with this enormous, enormous compassion for everybody. And so she was one of my teachers. So I'd gone to India in 1970. I did my first meditation retreat in January of 1971. That's where I met like Krishnadas and Ramdas and all these people. And then I came back. I'd gone through school. I came back, finished school, went back to India. And in 1974, I was leaving India for what I was totally convinced was going to be a very, very brief period of coming back to the States and just doing things I needed to do before I could go back to India and live there for the entire rest of my life.
Wow.
So I went to see Deepa Ma. She was living in Calcutta to say goodbye and get her blessing for what I was sure was this extremely, extremely brief period. She said to me, "When you go back, you'll be teaching." My friend Joseph Goldstein had already come back maybe 6 months before. So she said, "You'll be teaching with Joseph." And I said, "No, I won't." And she said, "Yes, you will." And I said, "No, I won't." And she said, "Yes, you will." And I said, "No, I won't." And then she said two things that were really amazing. One was she said, "You really understand suffering. That's why you should teach." And it's true. I'd had a life, not like hers, but, you know, like a childhood, certainly a lot of turmoil and difficulty. And I never really thought of it as kind of a credential for helping others, but of course it is.
Yeah.
She said, "You really understand suffering. That's why you should teach." And then she said, "You can do anything you want to do. It's just your thinking. You can't do it. That's going to stop you." And I left her room thinking, "No, I won't." And I came back to the States, and Joseph was at that point, Naropa Institute just opened up in Boulder, Colorado, and Joseph was there with Ram Dass and a bunch of people, and I ended up in Boulder, and then Joseph and I started teaching together, and every time I thought, that's where I met Jack, was in Boulder. And Jack Kornfield, yeah. So I thought, it's just for a little while, then I'll go back. Just for a little while, then I'll go back. And then,
hello?
One day I realized, that's actually my life now. So,
I'm sorry, Sharon, you're fading out a little bit.
Okay, so where did you lose me?
I lost you right when you were thinking, oh, I'll be going back, you know, I'll be going back soon, and then it faded out.
Yeah. So I, you know, Joseph and Jack and I would respond to these invitations, and I would teach, and every time I thought, I'll go back to India soon.
Yes.
And then one day I kind of woke up and I thought, oh, I'm not going back. You know, I'll go back to visit, but this is really my life now. And that's how I became a teacher. It's kind of the very old fashioned way, you know, through my own teachers.
Yes. Yeah. That's gotta be the right way. and when you're doing kind of what you just did with me, is there that, what is coming through? What is that? Is that considered the Dharma that's coming through? What would your teachers say is coming through a person when they open somebody up or help a person get a little unstuck?
Yeah, sure. It's a total blessing for me to be able to do it. And it's the Dharma coming through.
And do you feel like a conduit when that's happening? Do you feel something, or
I do. Yeah, I do.
Can you just,
it's not about me, you know, and I feel like, what clever thing can I say that will make a difference? It's not like conscious, you know, it's not even strategic. It's just getting more open.
Where is that energy coming from that's coming through you when you do things like that? What is that?
I think of it as the Dharma, you know, I don't think of it so much in personal terms, though I suppose I could think of it in terms of lineage or, you know, generations of teachers, but mostly I just think of it as a kind of truth that's available to all of us. And sometimes we're in a box and we can't quite access it all on our own. That's why we all, you know, we all kind of need one another.
Well, I am very glad that you did not stay in India, Sharon. and I'm very thankful, for you for giving me this interview. And, it's just it's so wonderful to get to chat with you. And to get to share you with the people who listen to this podcast. Is there a way that people can find you who listen to this and want to read your books or come to one of your teachings?
Definitely. Well, I have a website, which is SharonSalzberg.com.
Got it.
And
you're on Twitter, too.
I am. I'm at Sharon Salzberg. We follow each other.
We do. Yeah, it was a very exciting moment when you followed me on Twitter. I'm not going to lie. Well, Sharon, thank you so much. It's really incredible to get to chat with you. I really hope we could do it again soon or soonish.
Yes, I hope so too. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening. That was Sharon Salzberg. If you like what you heard, go to SharonSalzberg.com, order one of her books, or sign up for one of her retreats or seminars. Also, big thanks to Harry's Shave Club for sponsoring this podcast. If you go to Harry's.com and put in promo code FAMILYHOURHOLIDAY, you're going to get $5 off their Winter Winston package. So go do that. Help support this podcast. Give us a nice rating on iTunes. Massage your dogs. They love it. Their shoulders get so tight. You don't think those poor little guys are going to get stressed out, but they really do. So spend at least 20 minutes to 4 hours each day rubbing your dog's poor, tight shoulders. They're going to appreciate it, and you're going to get a lot of benefit from having relaxed dogs around the house. Have an excellent beginning of your December or whatever point in the time-space continuum you happen to be floating down, and I will see you soon. Hare Krishna.